Opponents of Alaska's predator control program argued their case today at the Alaska Supreme Court. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, the 19th of November. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, homeless people patch together their own services in Sitka.
You are the one that has to try to find the agency or the group or the church that's trying to help people like you. It's a monumental task, and it's probably too much to ask of somebody who has no resources.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Tech Alaska, operators of the Red Dog Mine in Northwest Alaska, delivering jobs and revenues to Alaska for 20 years and now working on the next 20 years. Online at reddogalaska.com. And by Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska. Primera believes the first job of a health plan is to support good health. More information available at primera.com.
Today, a panel of three state Supreme Court justices heard a case that threatens to overturn the law that underlies predator control programs. Ronald West argues that predators like wolves and bears have to be managed in a way that will assure their abundance in the future, just as prey species are. APRN Steve Heimel reports.
The West case is an appeal of a ruling that came down last year which wiped out state bounties for wolf hunting or trapping. Ronald West argues that the state constitution is very clear that all fishing game should be managed for sustained yield, and nowhere in it are predators exempted. He says in some parts of the state, the current goal is to wipe out 60 to 80% of the wolves and grizzly bears in hopes that more moose and caribou result. They have no idea the impact of that, he said. Where's the science? West argues that the law that requires intensive management of game for human use is unconstitutional. Assistant Attorney General Kevin Saxby said all the state's predator control programs do meet the constitutional standard. He told the judges that the reason the expression sustained yield does not appear often in fish and game regulations is that it can mean different things at different times. Saxby pointed to a commentary on the Constitution that does say it might not be in the public interest to apply sustained yield to pests and predators. He pointed to state efforts to wipe out foxes from the Aleutians and pike from lakes as examples. Saxby said the plaintiffs seem to want, quote, a very mechanical application that does not allow the state to prefer one species over another. Justice Dana Fabe at one point questioned Saxby about language for one predator control program that says grizzly bear numbers should be reduced, quote, as much as possible. Saxby said that was for just a small part of the game management unit, and there would be no danger to bears outside it. Also arguing the appeal was Attorney Mike Frank of Trustees for Alaska. He said there is nowhere in the record where the game board defines or applies sustained yield to predators, and like their bounty program, predator control regulations should be vacated. There's no indication how long it will take the court to decide the case. In Anchorage, I'm Steve Heimel.
Environmental groups are concerned the Obama administration is giving Shell Oil Company extra time to weigh in on proposed development plans for the Chukchi Sea. Shell wants to drill exploratory wells offshore next summer. Yesterday, the Federal Minerals Management Service said it's giving the company 10 days to respond to public comments collected on its plans. The spokeswoman for the environmental group Alaska Wilderness League, Emily Cerisco, says she hopes Alaska Native coastal communities and environmentalists who are against the plan can also weigh in.
Our concerns about the delay are just that MMS gives the same opportunities to all the affected parties. If they're going to allow Shell to review the comments and respond to them, then they should extend that courtesy to everyone who's part of the process.
However, Minerals Management Service spokesman Nicholas Pardee says the general comment period is over and many comments came in.
We collected, I think, about 300 pages of public comments on the exploration plan. So at this point, we're going to get Shell's response to those over 300 pages and then make a final decision on the exploration plan very, very quickly.
Pardee says Shell asked for the opportunity to respond to public comments, which is why MMS is granting it extra time. However, there's confusion over what exactly Shell requested. Shell President Marvin Odom says his company is actually eager for a decision on the Chukchi.
No, I don't believe we asked for a delay, but we're anxious in getting an answer to that that question as quickly as possible.
It now looks like MMS will announce a decision on whether Shell can go ahead with its development plan sometime after Thanksgiving. Despite the delay, conservation group Oceana says the process is moving too fast and in the oil company's favor. Jeffrey Short of Juno is Oceana's Pacific Science Director.
We're very concerned with the way that this process seems to be on a rigid track moving forward with no substantive opportunity to really examine the wisdom of these decisions in the first place.
Short and Shell President Marvin Odom testified today before the Senate Energy Committee about offshore energy development. The state's in-state gas line coordinator is leaving his job. Harry Noah announced plans to resign yesterday. The governor's oil and gas advisor, Gene Terrio, says Noah has a business in Oregon that needs his attention, but will stay on the job until the state finds a replacement for him. Terrio says the in-state gas project will remain on track.
The governor is still very much behind, you know, having this work be done. And so the money that was appropriated last year is being utilized. It's in for more funding in the coming budget year just to continue on that effort.
Terrio says the size of the pipe and the amount of volume it would carry are major issues. He says Anchorage and Fairbanks demand is not enough to leverage affordable gas, but that LNG export, gas to liquids, and fertilizer production could make the project economic. Fairbanks Republican Representative Jay Ramris disagrees with Terrio's assessment that the in-state project will remain on track. Ramirez says losing Noah is a big setback. He says Noah was a person who wanted to do a project, not a report, and he was undermined by state officials who did not support the in-state line. Ramirez is calling for House and Senate Resource Committee hearings.
You should not see an 800-pound gorilla like the Commissioner and Deputy Commissioner of Natural Resources, Tom Irwin and Marty Rutherford, come in and smother a 98-pound fledgling like the in-state gas pipeline project. And this is why I have spoken to all four of the co-chairs about holding joint or separate hearings on this issue.
Rammer says he is unhappy that Deputy Commissioner Rutherford wants to suspend the export agreement for Cook Inlet gas, saying an industrial anchor is needed to encourage more exploration in the Cook Inlet area. Reached by phone, Harry Noah did not want to comment on his resignation. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the Postal Service puts an end to a long tradition in North Pole.
The Grinch has already stolen Christmas and ran out of town, and unless his heart melts, we're in trouble.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com. And by AlaskaDispatch.com, reporting from across the state using multimedia and citizen journalism online to tell the story of our state. Find your Alaskan news at AlaskaDispatch.com.
A plane full of passengers made an emergency landing near the coast. The Federal Aviation Administration says that a Cessna 207 Skywagon went down about 14 miles southwest of Tuntutuliak. There were 8 passengers on board at the time. There were no injuries reported. The plane was operated by Ute Air, based out of Bethel. The plane had picked up passengers in Tuntutuliak and was en route to the village of Kipnuk when the engine failed. The pilot was forced to make an emergency landing on the tundra yesterday evening. Temperatures were below zero when the plane went down. Volunteers from Tuntutuliak Search and Rescue drove their snow machines over rough trail to reach the stranded passengers. 6 snow machines with 2 sleds full of warm weather gear were used to retrieve the passengers. Rescuers say they were all in good health. The infrastructure to help the homeless in Sitka has been compared to a patchwork of services and agencies without much unity, a problem that's not uncommon to other Alaskan communities. In the last installment of a three-part report on homelessness in Sitka, KCAW's Ed Ronco explores some of those patches and talks with people trying to stitch them together.
It's important to begin by saying that there are a number of people and groups in Sitka working to address homelessness, and there's no way this story, or any other story for that matter, can cover each of them. The best we can do is offer a glimpse, one that begins in the kitchen at the Salvation Army on Sawmill Creek Road.
What's for lunch today? Well, we originally had chicken soup. It was donated, and turned out it was spoiled, so I dumped the whole thing. Now it's called improvisation, and it's going to be a black bean and rice and beef soup.
David Kitka is sauteing those ingredients along with some onions and celery in a large skillet. On any given day, he'll serve lunch to about 25 people, maybe half of that in the summertime when it's easier to find work. Kitka himself used to be homeless. He says he became lost in addiction for 2.5 years. And volunteering now in the kitchen is his way of passing on the goodwill others showed him. The Salvation Army serves lunch from 11:30 to 12:30 every weekday, and it also runs a food pantry. The shelves line the entire room and are stacked high with boxes and cans. Salvation Army Captain Tina Botchin.
We usually provide about 5 days worth of food for a family. But that would be breakfast, lunch, and a dinner for them.
Botchin says her group also provides assistance with rent and utilities to keep people from losing their homes in the first place. And they sometimes provide hotel vouchers for people to get out of the cold for a night. There are a lot of things the Salvation Army can do, she says, but resources are still scarce. She has a phrase for what she does. She calls it soup, soap, and salvation.
My husband also has a saying, it's
Christianity
with its sleeves rolled up. Yeah.
You might say the sleeves are also rolled up at St. Peter's by the Sea Episcopal Church on Lincoln Street. It's open around the clock, year-round. The pastor, Father Dave Elsenson, says it's used by people needing comfort, rest, a moment of solitude.
And also people who find themselves without shelter.
He says it's been a mostly good experience for the church and that the parishioners feel strongly about keeping the doors open. But there have been some problems.
About 2 years ago, I started hearing reports from other people who were homeless asking me if these two people who were in the church building after dark had permission to run the place. If they could decide who could come in and who could not, and basically chase other people away.
And that was not okay with church leadership. Some new policies went up. The church building, it was decided, would be an appropriate place for solace, but not for eating, drinking, or sleeping. Elsenson says when people talk about homelessness, they talk about the system being broken. But he argues there never was a unified system. Instead, people who are homeless have to navigate a patchwork of groups and government agencies, some of which, he says, are tailored to very specific needs.
The problem is if you're not one of those targeted groups and you need help, then you are the one that has to try to find the agency or the group or the church that's trying to help people like you. It's a monumental task, and it's probably too much to ask of somebody who has no resources.
Those who can't find help or those who aren't looking for it sometimes end up in the care of police, brought in under something called Title 47, which basically says the police can hold people who pose a danger to themselves or others. Police Chief Sheldon Schmidt says the bulk of those calls are for public inebriation. The police measure Title 47 in man days. A man day is one night in jail for one person. So far, in 2009, they've logged about 200 of them. Last year, 125. Schmidt says he doesn't know why there's been an increase this year. Maybe it's the economy, maybe it's more people in town. He does say Sitka's policy on holding people is more permissive than in other places.
The jails oftentimes won't take them. They'll take them to the hospital, and the hospital will turn around and release them, and they're right back out on the street. And I just can't live with that, so we'll take them. Even if the hospital says, okay, they're medically cleared, but they're still intoxicated, we'll house them here.
Fair market rent for a two-bedroom apartment in Sitka is $1,024. Experts say affordable rent is about 30% of a household's median income. So, to afford $1,024 per month, a household would need the equivalent of $19.69 per hour in earnings. At minimum wage, those employed in the household would have to put in 110 hours of work each week. It's important to have good resources in town, but Elsenson, the pastor at St. Peter's, also says part of addressing the problem will mean changing societal attitudes about homelessness.
We are a people who believe in being able to pull yourself up by your bootstraps. If you work hard enough, you can do it. And the other side of that is, if you're down on your luck, it's probably your fault. I think we need to get over that. I think we need to be able to understand that sometimes things just don't work out for people. Sometimes it's their fault, sometimes it's not. But regardless, as a community, as a nation, it's in our interest to help each other.
Reporting in Sitka, I'm Ed Ronco.
Letters sent to Santa Claus are being returned or recycled due to a new Postal Service regulation. The national policy change follows an incident on the East Coast last December in which a volunteer responding to Santa letters was identified as a sex offender. The change affects post offices and community groups around the country that have traditionally worked together to answer Santa letters. But as KUAC's Dan Bross reports, it's hitting especially hard in the Christmas-themed city of North Pole.
North Pole's main street is Santa Claus Lane. There are candy cane light poles and a towering fiberglass statue of jolly old St. Nick. The city calls itself the place where the spirit of Christmas lives year-round. And the Postal Service's decision to stop releasing letters to Santa for local volunteers to answer has dampened that spirit.
The Grinch has already stolen Christmas and ran out of town, and unless his heart melts, we're in trouble.
That's North Pole Mayor Doug Isaacson. He says the community's 50-plus year tradition of answering some of the hundreds of thousands of letters sent to Santa has been largely shut down by the new Postal Service policy.
We've had organizations like Santa's Mailbag that since 1954 have been responding to these letters. We have civic organizations and churches and school kids and individuals and City Hall responding to these letters, but we're not going to be able to do this anymore.
U.S. Postal Service Alaska Region Consumer Affairs Manager Dawn Peppinger says the change is aimed at protecting kids.
We had a privacy concern that we had to address to protect the children. So this year's program changed to where we have to take extra steps to ensure that none of the personal information for the children are given to the third party.
The new rules allow postal employees to respond to Santa letters or redact identifying information so approved volunteers can. But Peppinger says that's not happening in Alaska due to the large volume of letters sent to North Pole and limited staffing to handle processing.
Unfortunately, with those extra steps required to track and redact and protect our children, we're not able to meet those to provide those letters to the third party.
The new rules do not affect letters accurately addressed to the North Pole nonprofit Santa's Mailbag, which coordinates community volunteer responses, or to businesses like the Santa Claus House in North Pole, which also receives many Santa letters. Santa Claus House Operations Manager Paul Brown says it does affect thousands of letters that only have limited address information.
Traditionally, what's happened in North Pole is that if kids have sent letters to Santa or written letters to Santa and mailed them and just put the address Santa Claus, North Pole, a lot of those will be redirected to the post office here in North Pole. And what North Pole has done in the past has taken those letters, collected them, and then passed them off to a nonprofit here in North Pole called Santa's Mailbag. And what's happening now is they can't distribute those letters anymore. So essentially what's going to happen is all those letters that are written by children are going to either be recycled or be stored or, you know, unfortunately be thrown away.
Brown says letters to Santa aren't just about fun. He says they sometimes get help to those in need.
They've received letters from kids that are going through a hardship or even from parents that are going through a hardship, and they have worked with nonprofits in the hometowns of the children or the adults that have written. So it's not just the response to the letters. It's also they do what they can to help out those that need help this time of year.
Many in North Pole feel taken by surprise by the Postal Service's policy change on Santa letters. Mayor Isaacson says the agency did not consult with the community before making its decision.
Instead of saying to us, what are you doing to ensure the safety of the children? Instead, they put onerous procedures and then said, if you don't want to comply with these procedures, you can opt out.
Isaacson is working with Alaska's congressional delegation to try to get the Postal Service to reconsider the Santa letter policy, as well as another recent action that affects North Pole holiday mail. Every year, hundreds of thousands of Christmas cards are mailed to Alaska to get a North Pole postmark, a service that's been handled through the Fairbanks Post Office, but is being moved to Anchorage. The Postal Service's Pepinger says Anchorage processing machines can better handle the Christmas mail. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the Alaska Engineering Fund, whose members include USKH Incorporated, a multidiscipline design firm offering architecture, engineering, planning, and environmental services. Information online at uskh.com. The University of Alaska now offers both a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts degree in fisheries. Fisheries students work directly with professionals in their field and enjoy hands-on learning through internships and research. Learn more at www.uaf.edu/fish. The UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, educating fisheries and marine science experts in Alaska for Alaska. This message sponsored by the UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences.
The Obama administration announced today $10 million in grants to help enroll Alaska Native and Native American children in health insurance programs. It's part of a broader push to get more kids covered by Medicaid and the Children's Health Insurance Program, or CHIP. The head of Health and Human Services, Secretary Kathleen Sebelius, says far too many Native children fall through the cracks and go without health insurance, even though they're entitled to it.
Approximately one-third of Native children are still uninsured, even though we know many of them are eligible for Medicaid or CHIP. One of the reasons, unfortunately, is geography. Native communities often are among the most remote in our country, and some Indian families may be hesitant to apply because they don't know enough about the Children's Health Insurance Program or about Medicaid.
Sebelius says Alaska Native and Native American children are uninsured at rates at higher than average rates. Congress passed a reauthorization and expansion of the Children's Health Insurance Program early this year, and it was one of the first bills President Obama signed into law. All three members of Alaska's congressional delegation voted for it. A report issued yesterday by Anchorage's municipal attorney contends that former mayor, now Senator Mark Begich, didn't fully tell the Anchorage Assembly about a developing financial shortfall in the city's revenues. Some assembly members, along with the current mayor, Dan Sullivan, say had they known about the revenue weakness, they would not have approved the existing 2009 budget and four union contracts. KSKA's Len Anderson reports.
The basis for Municipal Attorney Dennis Wheeler's finding lies in a section of the city charter saying, quote, if the mayor determines that revenues will be less than appropriations for a fiscal year, the mayor shall so report to the assembly. In his 60-page report released late yesterday afternoon, Wheeler concludes, quote, Mayor Begich knew that the revenues for the 2008 and 2009 budgets were reasonably certain to be less than appropriations and that the shortfall would have a significant impact on the municipality's financial well-being, but did not timely report this to the assembly. This year, the city experienced a multi-million dollar revenue shortfall and faces a crimped financial situation extending at least into the 2010 budget. Current Mayor Dan Sullivan says the lack of factual revenue information resulted in expenditures that are too high and union contracts too hastily approved. Municipal Attorney Wheeler does qualify his conclusion by saying, we understand our interpretation of what is required is not unassailable. Today in Washington, D.C., Senator Begich said Wheeler's report showed no real failure on his part.
If you look at the issues, they found without question
there is no violation of any law or charter, that the contracts are valid. I mean, the two issues they were to review. There's a lot of opinion in there by this attorney, but nothing substantiated by any facts or legal foundation.
Sullivan is a Republican, Begich a Democrat. Wheeler was appointed by Sullivan and replaced a Begich appointee in the municipal attorney's position. In his report, Wheeler cites emails among top administration members that indicate concern over a possible financial shortfall. He also includes transcripts from autumn budget work sessions and press releases from the mayor's office concerning the city's financial health in the face of the economic downturn. Anchorage Assembly Chair Debbie Osiander says while the findings may not show a mayoral violation of the city charter or that the union contracts can be canceled, the work session transcripts in Wheeler's report contain an important lesson.
The strongest thing out of the report for me personally at this time is the need to clarify and look more comprehensively at the ordinances that relate to requirements on financial reporting from the administration to the assembly so that we're sure we have all the information we need by certain dates.
Wheeler advises the assembly and Sullivan administration to amend the municipal code to avoid any further debate of exactly what the executive branch is expected to reveal concerning city finances. Osiander says the report's work session transcripts also offer a guideline for assembly members making future inquiries into budget matters.
There were certainly the questions there, but the follow-through to get it. I wish we'd been more aggressive in terms of really pushing to get it now.
Osiander says the assembly will discuss the report at its next regular session. In Anchorage, this is Len Anderson.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Shane Iverson in Bethel, Ed Ronco in Sitka, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Len Anderson in Anchorage. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Steve Heimel from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by First National Bank Alaska, working shoulder to shoulder with Alaskan businesses for nearly a century. Member FDIC, equal housing lender. And by Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska. Primera believes the first job of a health plan is to support good health. More information available at primera.com. The University of Alaska now offers both a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts degree in fisheries. Begin your UAF Fisheries degree at any major University of Alaska campus and finish in Fairbanks or Juneau. Learn more at www.uaf.edu/fish. The UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, educating fisheries and marine science experts in Alaska for Alaska. This message sponsored by the UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences. If heating your home costs more than you can manage and you have a low income, the state of Alaska has heating assistance programs that may help. The programs have expanded to include families with a higher household income. For information or an application form, call 1-800-470-3058 or visit heatinghelp.alaska.gov. Sometimes a little help makes all the difference. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.